meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
WRCT, the in sound from way out.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
The United States and its allies are preparing to send more weapons to Kyiv as fighting between Russia and Ukraine continues along a 300-mile front line in eastern Ukraine. We'll speak with a Ukrainian Democratic Socialist as well as a former resident of the Donbas. And we talk to Tony Wood, author of Russia Without Putin, Money, Power, and the Myths of the New Cold War.
It's likely to continue for some time unless a breakthrough can be made in peace negotiations. And while it would be great if that happened as soon as possible, I'm not optimistic about it happening anytime soon. And I think we could see several weeks, if not months more, of this war focused this time in the Donbas.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russian President Vladimir Putin's declared victory in Mariupol after Russian forces laid siege to the southern Ukrainian city for nearly 2 months. Putin's claim of liberation for Mariupol came as fighters and civilians remain holed up at a massive steel factory complex. A Marine commander of the remaining forces made a desperate appeal for international help with an evacuation.
This is our appeal to the world. This could be the last appeal of our lives. We are probably facing our last days, if not hours. All of us, Mariupol military battalion of soldiers, more than 500 wounded, and hundreds of civilians, including women and children. We plead to take us to safety on the territory of the third-party state.
Russia had been considering storming the steel complex, but for now has opted to blockade it. In eastern Ukraine, the governor of Luhansk says Russia now controls 80% of the region as fighting continues along a 300-mile front line. Russia's military has test-fired a new intercontinental ballistic missile capable of delivering nuclear warheads around the world. On Wednesday, President Vladimir Putin said a test of Russia's Sarmat missile had succeeded in hitting targets nearly 4,000 miles from a launch site in northwestern Russia.
This truly unique weapon will strengthen the combat potential of our armed forces, reliably ensure Russia's security from external threats, and provide food for thought for those who, in the heat of frenzied, aggressive rhetoric, try to threaten our country.
We'll have more on Russia's missile test and the war in Ukraine after headlines. German officials have pledged to stop importing oil from Russia by the end of the year. Germany's foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock of the Green Party, made the pledge during a visit to Latvia Wednesday.
Phasing out fossil fuels is a double security factor. Apart from the Russian threat, it is clear that we will only be able to create sustainable security and peace worldwide if we also take resolute joint action against the climate crisis. This includes becoming CO2 neutral in Europe as quickly as possible.
Russia receives about $1 billion a day from Germany and other European Union members from sales of coal, oil, and gas. Israeli warplanes bombed the Gaza Strip overnight, targeting what Israel said was an underground weapons factory. It was the second night of airstrikes on the besieged Palestinian territory this week. The assault came after Palestinian militants in Gaza launched a barrage of rockets at southern Israel. Many of them appeared to be intercepted by Israel's Iron Dome anti-missile system, though one rocket caused slight damage to a home in the Israeli city of Sderot. Meanwhile, in occupied East Jerusalem, at least 20 Palestinians were injured today as Israeli soldiers fired stun grenades, rubber bullets and pepper spray to clear worshippers from the Al-Aqsa Mosque after dawn prayers. This follows a similar crackdown last Friday that saw hundreds of Palestinians arrested and over the weekend over 150 injured. On Wednesday evening, Israeli police in Jerusalem blocked a march of more than 1,000 Israeli ultra-nationalist protesters from reaching the Old City's Muslim quarter, as many waved Israeli flags and shouted death to Arabs. Nicaragua's parliament has voted to shut down 25 non-governmental organizations that have criticized Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega. Groups banned include the Nicaraguan Permanent Human Rights Commission. This is the group's executive secretary, Marcos Carmona.
We regret this government is silencing the Nicaraguan Permanent Commission on Human Rights. We know they are affecting not only our institutions, but all people of Nicaragua. We were the only institution that documented the arbitrary abuses committed by different agencies of the state and by government officials.
Another group ordered closed in Nicaragua was the Luisa Mercado Foundation, which is run by Sergio Ramirez Mercado, an acclaimed Nicaraguan writer and former Sandinista who served as vice president under Ortega from 1985 to 1990. The Ortega administrations accused many of the organizations of accepting foreign funding and being involved in efforts to destabilize the Nicaraguan government. Here in the United States, the Justice Department says it'll appeal a federal judge's ruling that struck down a mask mandate on public transportation. Monday's decision by U.S. District Judge Catherine Kimball Mizell in Florida, a Trump appointee, voided the mask mandate for the entire nation. Judge Mizell was confirmed by Republican senators in 2020 to a lifetime appointment on the federal court at the age of just 33, even though the American Bar Association gave her a rating of not qualified. The judge's ruling blindsided Biden administration officials, even as they were considering allowing the public transit mask mandate to expire in May. In a statement, the Centers for Disease Control said it was well within its legal authority to protect public health when it ordered the mandate. The CDC added, quote, when people wear a well-fitting mask or respirator over their nose and mouth in indoor travel or public transportation settings, they protect themselves and those around them, including those who are immunocompromised or not yet vaccine eligible, unquote. The White House has finalized a rule change to the National Environmental Policy Act that restores several key provisions to the landmark 1970 law. The Trump administration gutted environmental and community safeguards under the act in 2020 when it moved to speed up the approval process for major infrastructure projects while exempting some projects from environmental review entirely. In more climate news, a wildfire burning north of Flagstaff, Arizona, exploded in size Wednesday to more than 20,000 acres, fanned by high winds and fueled by dry grass and brush. Arizona and other western states are suffering an unprecedented mega drought brought on by the climate emergency. 11 large wildfires are currently burning across the southwest and southern plains, with some 8 million U.S. residents under fire alerts today. The Military Times is reporting the Pentagon's moving forward on a plan to build and test portable micronuclear reactors to power military bases overseas and in remote areas in the U.S., despite warnings about high risks involved. In 2018, the Army published a list of possible sites where the micronuclear reactors could be deployed. Sites named included Guantanamo Bay, Diego Garcia, Guam, Fort Buchanan in Puerto Rico, and Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. Texas and Tennessee are both preparing to execute their oldest prisoners on death row today. In Texas, 78-year-old Carl Buncheon is scheduled to be killed just a week after he had to be rushed to a hospital due to chest pains. Longtime death penalty critic Sister Helen Bajan has called for Texas to halt the execution. In a tweet, she wrote, quote, Carl can barely walk and has been diagnosed with vertigo, arthritis, and other chronic illnesses. What does this execution have to do with public safety? She asked. Meanwhile, the state of Tennessee is scheduled to execute 72-year-old Oscar Franklin Smith today. In Ohio, an intensive care unit doctor accused of killing 14 patients has been found not guilty by a jury on all counts. Prosecutors accused Dr. William Husel of murdering 14 patients by giving them excessive doses of the powerful synthetic painkiller fentanyl. Husel's defense team argued he was attempting to give comfort to critically ill patients in severe pain. He still faces 10 civil lawsuits filed by families of his former patients. Florida's Republican-led Senate has voted to eliminate Walt Disney World's self-governing status. The move is widely seen as retaliation by Governor Ron DeSantis and his allies over Disney's opposition to Florida's so-called Don't Say Gay law. In other news from Florida, the Republican-led state Senate has approved a new congressional map that critics say is designed to curtail black political power in the state. Florida State Senator Chevron Jones criticized the redistricting plan.
And to Governor DeSantis, I'm not going to call what you're doing a culture war anymore. I'm going to call it just what it is. Okay. It's a racist tactic that you're doing. And you know what you're doing.
Do it again. And in Georgia, a majority of workers at an Apple store in Atlanta have filed a petition for a union election. If they vote to join the Communication Workers of America, the workers will form the first union at an Apple retail store in the United States. Union organizers say Apple employee pay has failed to keep up with inflation and Apple's soaring profits in recent years. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has ordered a blockade of a massive steel complex in the southeastern Ukrainian city of Mariupol, where thousands of Ukrainians are holed up, including civilians and fighters, with two regiments, the 36th Marine Brigade and the far-right Azov Brigade. Russia had been considering storming the complex, but for now has opted to blockade it. This comes as Putin claims Russia has, quote, liberated the rest of the city, which has been devastated by weeks of Russian attacks. In eastern Ukraine, fighting is continuing along a 300-mile front line. The governor of Luhansk says Russia now controls 80% of the region. Luhansk is one of two regions that make up the Donbas in eastern Ukraine. The United States and its allies are continuing to funnel weapons to Ukraine. On Wednesday, President Biden met with U.S. military leaders at the White House.
Weapons and ammunition are flowing in daily, and we're seeing just how vital our alliances and partnerships are around the world.
In other developments, the prime ministers of Spain and Denmark are in Kyiv today for talks with Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch has released a report accusing Russia of committing war crimes in Bucha, a suburb of Kyiv. The group said it found extensive evidence of summary executions, enforced disappearances, and torture. We're joined now by Denis Pilash, a Ukrainian political scientist and historian, member of the Ukrainian Democratic Socialist Organization, Szanyruch, or the Social Movement. He's also an editor at Commons, Journal of Social Criticism. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Denis. It's great to have you with us. If you can start off by talking about the resistance in Ukraine. We hear a lot about the military resistance, but if you can talk about overall the kind of resistance that doesn't get coverage.
And really, Ukraine, it stands not due just to the military resistance, though hundreds of thousands of people have volunteered to either the armed forces or the territorial defense units, but also due to millions of people who are engaged in just these humanitarian efforts and keeping the things running. For instance, the essential workers, the railroad workers, the employees of the state railway companies, they did a really heroic job by evacuating millions of people fleeing from the most dangerous regions to the safer ones. And actually, dozens of them have been killed, and many were killed while performing their duties. The same applies to healthcare workers, nurses and doctors who are risking their own lives to save others. And again, Russia is targeting hospitals as well. And so many of these people are killed as well. And in general, we have these spontaneous networks of non-hierarchical solidarity that emerged on ground in different regions and cities throughout the country, who help the people who had to relocate, and also who help to distribute the humanitarian aid, medicine, food, and so on. And altogether, this constitutes the backbone of the Ukrainian resistance.
And Dennis, I want to ask about the just yesterday, we reported it in our introduction, the release of this Human Rights Watch report on war crimes in Bucha. You had said in March, a month ago, that Putin's war crimes are following in the footsteps of the war crimes committed by governments like the United States. But since these massacres in Bucha, you've said the correct analogy now might be to what Indonesia did following the occupation of East Timor, or what Pakistan did in West Pakistan did to East Pakistan, now Bangladesh, in the war in 1971. Could you elaborate on that? What do you see as the war changed, how the war has changed since March, and why you think these situations are now more accurate?
I think that it's really the same crime of military aggression that was done by numerous other governments and other imperialists as well. And in this case, Putin's war in Ukraine, or his wars in Chechnya, or Yeltsin's war in Chechnya, were in the same line with, say, Bush and Blair and their cronies attacking Iraq. But the intensity of these atrocities that were revealed with these horrible pictures from Bucha, Irpin, Borodyanka, and other Kyiv suburbs, they show us all scale of atrocities, starting from sexual violence, from torture, and to mass executions. And here we see also some kind of ideological explanation by some of the in the Russian propaganda machine that Ukraine, in a way, has to be, cleansed. And this leads us to these analogies, not just with many have recalled Srebrenica and what happened in the wars in the former Yugoslavia in the 90s, but really to what happened, for instance, when pro-American dictator Suharto occupied East Timor and unleashed acts of genocide against the local population in the 1970s. So we see that in some places, the reality of this occupation is so brutal that it leads to mass obliteration of human lives.
And so, Dennis, do you support the continued supply of weapons to Ukraine, which is exponentially increasing now, despite the fact that many say supplying these weapons will only prolong the war?
You see, if making analogies, so maybe supplying Soviet and Chinese weapons to Vietnam, they also prolonged the resistance of the Vietnamese, and thus they prolonged the war. But it was still a unilateral aggression done by an imperialist power, in that case the US, in this case Putin's Russia. And just in order to preserve human lives that are lost in all these airstrikes and shellings, because civilians are dying massively throughout the country, and actually no place in the country can be really safe, as objects, including civilian objects, including schools and hospitals, have been hit in many parts. So, for instance, having anti-aircraft weaponry, it really preserves these people who are hiding in their basements, in their apartments, and so on. But in a way, these supplies, we also have to remember that Russia also used to be supplied with Western weapons from Germany, France, and from other countries, and that even now it's still fueled by these payments for the Russian oil and gas. So it can be said that there are more German parts in Russian tanks than American munition in Ukrainian arms. But in general, we need to oversee that this military assistance that is needed by the Ukrainian resistance, that it will go to Ukrainians, and it's not just used as a pretext for this, you know, increasing of military industrial complexes in the other Western countries, because no one is gaining from more militarized Germany or US. It's really up to the people on the ground, up to the people in Ukrainian resistance who need this, not you know, the interests of these companies that have to be preserved.
So, Denis Balash, let me ask you about the Azov Battalion, because the U.S. has a rule that weapons to Ukraine can't go to them. But right now, with the massive influx of weapons, there's no way that they can be traced to where. You've been a fierce critic of the far right in Ukraine. What are your thoughts on this? And also a fierce critic of the expansion of NATO. And now you have Sweden, you have Finland saying they want to join NATO, although it looks like one of the reasons for this invasion, Ukraine being a part of NATO, was actually not a possibility for years to come.
It was really just a pretext that was brought along by the Russian propaganda. And actually, I think that the main promoter of NATO was Vladimir Putin himself, who actually pushed, these were the words, for instance, of Ilya Ponomarev, the only MP in the Russian parliament who voted against the annexation of Crimea, that this will lead to pushing Ukraine in the arms of NATO. And now he's doing the same with Finland and Sweden. And regarding the Azov, that is now not a battalion for 7 years, but a regiment in the National Guards of Ukraine. Well, it's just one unit in the general resistance that now, I think, it's really up to 500,000 people who are engaged either in the army or in these territorial defense units. And most of it are now really blockaded in the Mariupol, a city that has lived through a really brutal siege, and maybe the atrocities there, when they are revealed, maybe they will compare to those in Kyiv Oblast. So I think that in reality, now this group, it constitutes a tiny faction in the general Ukrainian military resistance, and I don't think that it's so important, both in terms of like percentage or compared with the rest of the military and of the National Guards and so on, neither in the context of its political influence, because again, the far right in Ukraine never was really popular electorally, and it never had a mass social base for it.
And Denis, I'd like you to elaborate on a point you made about this in another recent interview on the Azov Regiment. You said that, quote, just as our understanding of the corruption of the Abbas administration and the far-right nature of Hamas shouldn't be an obstacle to hearing the plight of the Palestinians, so should the presence of the right wing in Ukraine not be a way of not listening to the plight of the Ukrainians. Could you elaborate on that, how you see the two situations as at all analogous?
I think that, yeah, any analogy is, well, they can be still very far away, but the core of the both situation are is that you need to really address the people from below, the grassroots. You need to hear the plight of men and women who are suffering and who are struggling in both cases. And actually using all this, you know, invoking the problems that exist in every context, it's just a pretext for remaining, trying to remain neutral. But as the late Archbishop Desmond Tutu said, when you are neutral in a conflict between an oppressor and an oppressed, you are actually playing on the side of the oppressor. So, and here I think that so much attention has been attributed to the far right in Ukraine, and actually we lost also the far right on the other side of the war, and actually we lost the moment when, like I can address the Russian sociologist Greg Yudin, who shows how the Russian regime itself became more and more fascist. So it was becoming an open, like, far right dictatorship, and this war, it's a massive step in not just stirring up all these nationalist feelings throughout Eastern Europe in other countries, but first of all, it was boosting the ultra-nationalist sentiment in Russia, and it was boosting the repressive apparatus in Russia, and it was suppressing any kind of discontent and actually almost wiping out the anti-war protests. So, again, the big problem here is that we have an imperialist power that is now run by a far-right regime, not in just in terms of its ideology, invoking Ivan Ilyin and other fascist thinkers, but in terms of its praxis, what it has already done, not just in Ukraine, but in many other places in the post-Soviet space, which it regards as, for instance, U.S. does towards the Latin American region, that it's its backyard and it's entitled to do whatever it wants. It does the same to the neighboring countries in the case of Russia.
Denis Pilash, you have been fiercely critical of the role Russian oligarchs have played. I mean, back to 2014, Russia's annexation of Crimea. But you've also talked about the involvement of the Ukrainian elite. If you can talk about who they are and their significance today and if your views have changed.
Well, actually, the Russian and Ukrainian elites, the oligarchic capitalist class, they came from the same source. So they were a result of this primitive accumulation of capital in the 90s. The people who grabbed in mostly criminal manner the riches of the countries and who actually devastated their own citizens, to become part of the global capitalist class, of the global ruling class. I think the slight difference is obviously that in Russia, the presence of more this siloviki, that is security services people and also more bureaucratic layers, it's stronger, but it's still preserving the interests of Russian big capital. And in case of Ukraine, you have a number of these competing oligarchs that tried not just to control the economy, but also to influence and control the political decisions in the country, and who are still playing the same, and who also have shown their contempt towards their own citizens, not just by many of them had fled like prior of the invasion, they just left Ukraine, but they continue this looting of the country, and they try to, you know, to store as their Russian colleagues to store what was stolen from their people in tax havens. And this is why when we speak about, for instance, seizing the assets of oligarchs, be it or Russian or Ukrainians, we also need to address the issue of this offshore capitalism of the tax havens, where the majority of these oligarchic elites, they prevent not just paying taxes, but also to prevent being to see the ways how they were exploiting the countries.
So, Dennis, could you explain, do you think this oligarchical class in either Ukraine or Russia is benefiting from this war? And who are the beneficiaries of this war, as you see it?
Well actually, this war has gone so irrational that it seems that the gains that can be won by some in the elites, they are really nothing compared to the destruction that is brought on. And actually, I think it really transcended beyond like real rationale, some real rational motivation. But actually, in any case of war or other, you know, this harsh situation, it's like the shock doctrine. Yes, the ruling class, it grabs this opportunity to curtail the rights and freedoms of the masses as much as they can, and also to make their power stronger. So obviously it was the case with Russia. Then Russian this vertical of power, it become even more centralized and autocratic. And these people who are in power for, like Putin and his cronies, being in power for 20 years and being unchecked and having no feedback and no democratic procedures from below. And in Ukraine, we also see that, for instance, our neoliberal MPs just today, they tried to pass a law that will make easier to lay off workers, to curtail their labor rights. So the same people who are now essential for the defense of Ukraine, their rights have been attacked and are being attacked by the elites who use the situation of the war maybe to reducing the space of the rights of workers and of unions. So it's the case, I think, in almost any war that we see today. This one is no exception.
And Dennis, finally, what do you see as a possible conclusion of this war? What kinds of concessions would Ukraine have to make? Are those either likely or desirable? How will this end?
It's hard to predict. And actually, another point for having armaments to Ukraine is to make this analogy with the people who are involved in trade unions organizing. They know that to negotiate with the boss who is stronger than you, you also need to have some power on your side. And it seems now that Russia is still pushing for some kind of for having the opportunity to grab a bigger chunk of Ukraine and probably to grab a bigger parts of eastern Ukraine. And that's why it isn't at this point actually willing to have a like clear and equal negotiation with the Ukrainian side. And this is why we so desperately need to have Russia on the table to sit and to really negotiate a real ceasefire and not what was done like previously, when even opening humanitarian corridors usually meant that they are endangered by Russian shellings and Russian fire. But we have also seen that Russian military has been quite inefficient in many ways, and their first expectations of that they will have a very smooth blitzkrieg, it failed. they failed, and now they are still going to present some kind of victory to their population and to for their propaganda as well. But it seems that really there are many possible outcomes, and some of them are really terrible. But with having enough international solidarity, that means also pushing through a broader vision of what has to be done to help Ukraine. It's not just humanitarian or military aid or helping the refugees. It's also the issue of cancellation of Ukrainian external debt. It's the issue of preserving a framework for the rebuilding, the recovery of the country in a more socially just and inclusive way. It also means to envision an eco-socialist alternative to the existing neoliberal capitalism that will exclude such fossil fuel autocratic empires as modern Russia or modern Saudi Arabia that is waging equally criminal war in Yemen are. And also to really democratize the international order, not to resort to, you know, this playing of big grand powers that view the world as just some playground for redistributing of the spheres of influence, but to really give voice and to empower the smaller countries and their people to really stop this domination of big imperialist powers like the US, Russia, China, and you can continue the list. So it's really to we need a more complex vision for the future in order to not just to stop this war, but to prevent further ones.
We want to thank you, Denis Pilash, for joining us, Ukrainian political scientist, historian, member of the Ukrainian Democratic Socialist Organization, translated into English, the Social Movement, a leftist party created by the working people of Ukraine, also an editor of Commons, Journal of Social Criticism, speaking to us from Western Ukraine. Next up, we speak with Tony Wood, author of Russia Without Putin, Money, Power, and the Myths of the New Cold War. Stay with us.
Місто вогні, серце болить, втомлює біль, і ворог не спить. Кулі летять, поки падає сніг, і ворог лежить, мовчить. Ночі без сну, нам не холодно, чекає сім'я на околицях. Разом ми всі переможемо, це наша рідна земля. Хай буде весна, там де ми стоїмо до кінця, і нас не зламає війна. Наша віра єднає серця,
It will be spring by the Ukrainian singer and songwriter Max Barsky. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. As we turn now to Russia to look at the impact there of President Putin's invasion of Ukraine now in its eighth week. On Wednesday, the U.S. launched another round of sanctions against Russia. The U.S. State Department's reportedly considering whether to recognize Russia as a state sponsor of terrorism. As the Russian military pushes for a victory in eastern and southern Ukraine, Putin's made repeated warnings to the U.S. and other countries about supplying Ukraine's army with weapons. On Wednesday, he appeared on Russian television to announce the launch of a new intercontinental ballistic missile system capable of delivering nuclear warheads around the world.
This truly unique weapon will strengthen the combat potential of our armed forces, reliably ensure Russia's security from external threats, and provide food for thought for those who, in the heat of frenzied, aggressive rhetoric, try to threaten our country.
This comes as thousands of Russians are reportedly fleeing the country amidst the Kremlin's crackdown on protests against the war in Ukraine and on independent media outlets following the passage of a new law that prohibits the, quote, discrediting the Russian armed forces. For more, we're joined by Tony Wood, member of the editorial board of the New Left Review, where his recent piece is headlined Matrix of War and looks at how the present conflict developed, the possible scenarios that lie ahead, author of Russia Without Putin, Money, Power, the Myths of the New Cold War. Tony Wood, welcome back to Democracy Now! This invasion has been a catastrophe for Ukraine. You also, though, point out that this has been suicidal for Russia. You were shocked by what Putin did. Can you talk about why you believe he did it and the response of the Russian people?
Yeah, thanks for having me back on the show, Amy. And you're absolutely right. The main focus here is the catastrophe that this war has been for the Ukrainian people. In terms of why Putin decided to launch this invasion, it did catch certainly many analysts off guard. I think this partly the scale of it, the level of aggression, but also the initial war aims, which involved seemingly toppling the Ukrainian government and installing a puppet regime, right, decapitating the Zelensky government, and the so-called denazification, which I'm sure previous guests have talked about, but this idea that Ukraine is ruled by a far-right junta, this is the word they use in Russian state media, and so this needed to be overthrown. And this was just, frankly, delusional set of war aims. And so the question here is was there just such a catastrophic intelligence failure in the Russian leadership that they thought they could pull this off? And here it bears repeating that, you know, in 2004, the Russian-backed candidate rigged an election in Ukraine, and that was the source of popular protests, and that resulted in fresh, more transparent elections that produced a pro-Western leader. So just to bear in mind, 16 years ago, Russia couldn't help rig an election in Ukraine, and here we are in 2022 with the Russian government seemingly thinking they can impose a puppet government. So the shock was not just the fact of the war itself, but the scope and the character of these, frankly, delusional war aims. What we're seeing now with the turn of Russian forces to the Donbass and to a much more conventional land war in the Donbass is much more like the war that has already been happening in Ukraine since 2014, but on a much larger scale and a much more destructive scale. And that looks much more, sadly, much more like what one might have expected from the troop buildup in early parts of this year. In terms of the motivations for launching it, I think there's a complex of different things here. There's a layering of thinking in the Russian elite. And I should say it's not just Putin who thinks this. I think this kind of thinking is quite widespread. There is the issue of NATO expansion, and we can talk a bit more about the nature of that in Russian calculations. But there is also just the fact of Ukrainian sovereignty that the Russian leadership, again, not just Putin, has found very hard to digest and to respect. And that is something they're keen to curtail, to limit. And the fact that a sovereign Ukraine might choose to lean in a Western direction and join the EU is something that Russian strategic calculations can't allow. But the timing is also somewhat mysterious because I don't think, again, there was so much to be lost from the Russian end alone, actually. There was so much to be lost by carrying out this act of aggression and so little to be gained that something about it still doesn't really hold together rationally, I think.
Tony, you've said that in the last decade or so, the internal divisions within Ukraine have been turned into a zero-sum battle between rival geopolitical interests. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, broadly speaking, since Ukraine gained independence in the early 1990s, it has tried to kind of balance between two rival power blocks on either side. And one was Russia. And one was a combination of NATO and the EU. Both of these projects, the Russian project was very much weaker in crisis, that had really nothing to offer in the 1990s. After the 2000s, there was more economic growth in Russia, and Russia had more of an ambition to reassert its influence in neighboring states, what it called the near abroad. And by the 2010s, Russia had a kind of regional economic integration project, the Eurasian Union, so-called. And it wanted Ukraine to be a key element in that broader regional economic strategy, if you like, a kind of power block against the EU.
On the other side, you have obviously the EU, as I just mentioned, which is a sort of very large scale, not just an economic project, actually. It does involve fairly profound re-engineering of societies, of their legal structures, their regulatory regimes. And also, incidentally, this is often forgotten, but the EU integration process does involve a military component. It does involve coordination of militaries. On top of that, you have NATO, which is the US-led European security architecture, and a lot of Eastern European states in the 1990s tilted in the direction of NATO as seeking security guarantees. For a time in the 1990s and early 2000s, Ukraine could really balance between these two and was not forced into a choice between them. It was constitutionally neutral. It was not allowed to have foreign military bases on its territory. And that was an arrangement that broadly worked. But increasingly after the 2000s, I would say, and certainly in the 2010s, this became a zero-sum choice that you couldn't actually balance between these two. You had to actually choose between the two. EU integration was not compatible with continued economic ties on the same scale as before with Russia. And certainly you couldn't choose to balance between these two security architectures. As far as a section of the Ukrainian elite was concerned, there was a risk in maintaining neutral status. And so they plumped very hard for NATO membership. But I should say that until relatively recently, NATO membership did not have majority support in the Ukrainian population. So just to echo what your previous guest, Denis Pilash, said, that actually, you know, Putin has really been the best recruiting sergeant for NATO, not just in Ukraine, but in Eastern Europe as a whole.
And do you think, Tony, that fact also corroborates what our previous guest, Denis, said, namely that NATO was simply a pretext for this war, and other observers who've suggested that this is kind of the scale and really irrationality, as you've said, of the Russian invasion is simply the last gasp of a collapsing empire?
I think it certainly is. It's an important pretext. But I think in a way, you know, there's an effort here to kind of separate out NATO from what is happening in order to describe Russian actions purely from the Russian side. And I think unfortunately, that's not how geopolitics works. These things, you know, Russia's act of aggression is very much its own responsibility, and it will have to bear that criminal responsibility for decades to come. But these decisions are not made in a vacuum. And so the question of NATO expansion is necessarily part of this context. In terms of assigning blame, obviously, it's very clearly the blame lies with Russia for this act of aggression. But I think we can't extract NATO from understanding the conflict, the buildup to the conflict. And the analogy I often make here is with World War One, that actually, you know, in a very narrow sense, Germany invaded Belgium and that was the cause of the war. But if we extract all of the great power rivalries that led up to World War One, all of the arms buildup, all of the tensions over the Balkans, all of that stuff, if we extract that from our understanding of World War One, we have zero understanding of how it actually took place. So I think NATO does need to be factored in here. And I think, you know, the question there, in a sense, it's unanswerable. If people are so sort of clear that NATO was just a pretext and it didn't have any real bearing on how this conflict came about, then the question really becomes, why was NATO expansion so unquestionably necessary? Why was it necessary to overturn Ukraine's neutral status? I mean, I think NATO is definitely relevant to this because it supplied a pretext for Russia, if you like. Why create that pretext? Why not remove the pretext? And then you can have a different set of conversations about Russian imperialism and Russian power projection in the near abroad.
Your book, Tony Wood, is Russia Without Putin. Do you think this invasion could lead to that? And you've described what could happen next as this just long war of attrition. What about the alternative? What do you think could be a ceasefire, an outcome in terms of Ukraine preserving its territorial integrity? What will happen in the Donbas and Crimea as well?
Yeah, I guess those are two very large and complex questions, but I'll try and get to them as quickly as I can. I mean, in terms of the future scenarios, I think that unfortunately a war of attrition of some kind, I mean, again, very much different from World War One in this sense because of the sheer destructive power available to certainly to the Russian army. I think something like that is likely in the coming weeks. I think it's and the problem here is that wars have a tendency to create their own dynamics and perpetuate themselves. And at a certain point, it becomes, and especially after the atrocities that you were discussing earlier in the show, it's going to become very hard within Ukraine to make a moral case for peace. I think, understandably, people are not going to be ready to make any kind of negotiations, let alone any concessions to Russia at this point. And it becomes very difficult to see the off-ramp from either side. So, you know, initially there were these negotiations that seemed to lay out the terms of a potential settlement. And I think that has now shifted. One of the reasons for that, I think, is that in a way the severity and the coordinated nature of the Western US-led response to Russia, the scale of the sanctions, the economic impact on Russia, has really backed the Russian elite into a corner here where they really have nothing else to lose. I mean, the destructive impact on the Russian economy is already pretty severe. They've tried to shield themselves from it in whatever way they can. But really, they don't have a massive incentive now not to pursue some kind of military victory or something they can call a victory before pursuing a peace settlement. And I guess this gets back to your first question of what is the likely outcome in Russia. Sadly, I do not think a substantive change in the nature of the Russian regime is likely. And I think this is partly gets back to the nature of sanctions in general. Certainly these sanctions, but I think sanctions in general, they don't really work. They have often the reverse effect to that intended. They will often consolidate a national population around the leadership on patriotic grounds, and that's certainly what's been happening in Russia, thanks to official media. But very importantly, they also consolidate the elite around the leadership. This was already the case in 2014, and I think there's a misunderstanding here in the West of the impact of those sanctions, that the idea that in 2022 you could impose sanctions that would somehow split the Russian elite from Putin and lead to a palace coup, this is really false. The Russian elite has already been fully consolidated around Putin since at least 2014, if not before. And so these sanctions are not going to split them off. They're going to rally them even further. And so I think that elite has much less of a reason to back down. You know, we see this in some reports of Russians who have fled the country in order to escape the climate of repression that's building there. Several of them have had to go back to Russia because the effect of the sanctions cuts them off from access to any of their finances. They can't, you know, get jobs. I mean, all of these things that actually, in a way, what we're seeing with the sanctions is kind of cutting off Russia from the rest of the world in a way that makes it much more likely that they will turn it even further in a nationalist direction. And I think this is a trap. It's very difficult to see what to do. But my broader anxiety here is that in responding to the very immediate emergency of war, there is less of a focus on what could produce a peace. And I think that is going to be my worry, is that becomes much harder to see as time goes on. And that's why I think the war will continue, unfortunately.
Tony Wood, we want to thank you for being with us, member of the editorial board of the New Left Review. We'll link to your piece, Matrix of War, also author of Russia Without Putin, Money, Power, and the Myths of the New Cold War. When we come back, we speak to a former resident of Donbas in 30 seconds. Questions in a World of Blue by Mekel Volny. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermin Sheikh. In eastern Ukraine, fighting is continuing along a 300-mile front line. The governor of Luhansk says Russia now controls 80% of the region. Luhansk is one of two regions that make up the Donbas in eastern Ukraine. For more, we go to Brian Milikovsky, expert in economic recovery in eastern Ukraine, who's also hoping to raise funds for evacuations from Donbas. He's joining us from Croatia. Until January, he lived in the Donbas. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about the conditions there, the strategic importance of this area, and what a war of attrition means in the Donbas?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me. conditions are really horrifying. Looking through my smartphone at what's going on in the city where I've been living the last 6 years, where I was married, started a family, and have been working, Severodonetsk, which is the temporary capital of Luhansk Oblast, while Luhansk itself has been under Russian control since 2014. Looking through my smartphone at what's happening, it really looks like a post-apocalyptic video game. It's horrifying that these kinds of conditions are possible to reach, especially in such a short time. I mean, I think many people have seen that Mariupol, a much larger city, has been basically turned to a charred ruin. Places like Severodonetsk are in a somewhat earlier stage, but nonetheless, it's just almost virtually every one of these classic Soviet apartment blocks is scarred by multiple direct hits. Huge fires would burn up the sides of these buildings, you know, charring them black. There's almost not a single public object in the city that I was living in that hasn't been severely damaged. And the strategic value of a place like Severodonetsk, if we were to compare it to Mariupol, right, which is located along the Azov Sea coast, where, you know, between Russia and the occupied Crimean Peninsula, Mariupol, I think, really has strategic certain amount of value as part of Russia's invasion. I really think seizing places like Severodonetsk or Kramatorsk, another large eastern city that the government currently controls, is really primarily symbolic for Putin and Russia. It's this belief they have, fanatical belief, that the East really must be actually a part of Russia. And that's what's so horrifying, is that they're leveling these cities without, A, that basis of support that they thought was there. They really believed they'd be met, as you know, Russians and Ukrainians say, with bread and salt. And they're leveling these cities in order to instead, you know, forcibly take them away. And then it's not really clear for what purpose, except boistering their own narrative. And they will not have the resources at all under such intense sanctions and with oil embargoes going on to do anything with territories they're trying to seize. So, of course, those of us who were living in the East really pray that even with all this destruction, it remains under Ukrainian control.
Brian, could you talk about the situation in Donbas since 2014? I mean, it's hardly been a peaceful place. According to the UN, 14,000 people have been killed on both sides.
Yes, about 3,500 of whom were civilians. We really need to remember what a toll there was on civilians in the region. I only lived and worked in the government-controlled areas. It's often forgotten that 60% of the Donbas remains, until this war began, under the control of the Ukrainian government. And what I would say is it took an enormous socioeconomic blow in 2014, severed commercial relations, value chains, and severed, you know, personal and family ties. It was an enormous tragedy to see the region cut in two when Russia launched its separatist project that led to Donetsk, Luhansk, and other major cities coming under Russian and separatist control. But in the government-controlled areas, in this sort of space over the last 7 to 8 years, there was a reasonable recovery. I've been working in humanitarian and development work during that time. There was, you know, decentralization by the Ukrainian government led to significant improvements, actually, in the quality of urban spaces in these places. There was a diversification in the business community, in end markets they were working on, a slow but precious recovery, which is being obliterated by this war. And that's, of course, that's really difficult to watch, because it was so important that the part of the Donbas under government control was stabilizing, and you could see the framework of a pretty good economic future slowly being built there after the shock of 2014. And really, we're just seeing that be obliterated before our eyes.
Brian, we're going to do part two of this discussion and post it at democracynow.org. But very quickly, we have 30 seconds. If you can talk about the civilian-led effort of evacuation that you're helping to lead right now from the Donbas.
Ukrainian volunteers are getting thousands of people out in school buses, delivery vans, compact cars, It's an entirely civilian-led intervention, volunteer-led, no big organizations involved in this for the time being, but we've got out more than 8,000 people so far through this means, mostly from Luhansk Oblast. People who are interested in that can find out more about how I gather donations for that on my Facebook page, Brian Milikovsky. But this is really work being done by extraordinary Ukrainian volunteers who gained experience in 2014 with exactly this kind of disaster.
Well, we want to thank you for being with us, Brian Milikovsky, expert in economic recovery in eastern Ukraine, who until January lived in Severodonetsk in Ukraine. That's in the Donbass, helping raise funds for evacuations now from the Donbass. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is an immediate opening for a news writer-producer. Visit democracynow.org/jobs to find out more and apply. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Camille Baker, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Everybody ready?
Everybody,
and welcome to episode 2215 of Whiskey Before Breakfast on WRCT Pittsburgh, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark, Delaware, WUTC and WUTC HD1 Chattanooga, Tennessee, Tube City Online Radio from McKeesport, Pennsylvania, and Mountain Streams Radio from WKYWLP Kaiser, West Virginia. I am Mando Richard, and we've got a great show for you all lined up. We'll start off on the liquored up side of the family like we always do. We'll end up on the gospel side of the family like we always do. And in between, we've got lots of interesting music for you. Let's get started by going back to that old 1962 LP that the New Lost City Ramblers put out called American Moonshine and Prohibition Songs. And it's going to start off today with that tearjerker, I Saw a Man at the Close of Day.
I saw a man at the close of day standing round the grocery door. His eyes were sunk, his lips were parched, and I viewed him o'er and o'er. His little son stood by his side, and unto him he said, "Oh, father, mother, sick at home, and sister cries for bread." He turned around, went in at the door, he staggered up to the bar, and faltering unto the landlord said, "Just give me one." one glass more. A crowd stood around the door. I asked the reason. One replied, the drunkard is no more. Just then a hearse moved slowly by, no wife or children near. They had gone before this vile murder and left this world of care. The mole, you jolly dram drinkers, by this a warning take, and quit the overflowing.